Good afternoon, New York, and the rest of our listeners around the globe. My name is June Stoyer, and I'm the host of the Clean Energy View radio show. Our podcast's archives are available on iTunes, Zune, and you can also find them on our website, which is www.cleanenergyview.com. If you have any questions for our guests, there are many ways you can contact the show. You can post a question on our wall on Facebook, Skype us, send us a tweet on Twitter to @CleanEnergyView, or contact me directly at June Stoyer. If you'd like to be on the show or would like to find out about sponsorship opportunities, please contact us at info@CleanEnergyView.com. Today my guest is Douglas Shields, and we're going to be talking about fracking and why fracking doesn't make sense. Now, in the Northeast, there's an area that extends throughout much of the Appalachian Basin called the Marcellus Shale. This area, located in the Northeast, seems to offer the perfect resource to produce more gas and, according to the gas companies, create new jobs. The shale contains largely untapped natural gas reserves and has now become the prime focus for energy development. The natural gas industry is spending millions of dollars to sell the merits of drilling for gas in the Marcellus Shale. The process of extracting the gas is called hydrofracking, or more commonly referred to as fracking. When it comes to natural gas development, there are many concerns not only about the environment, but about health and land value as well. So today we're going to be talking about what the financial risks are involved with leasing your land. Also, what rights do you have if your neighbor's land is leased? And all sorts of questions such as, if fracking is going to make its way to New York State, and exactly how economically viable is fracking for the Northeast? So I would like to welcome to the show Mr. Douglas Shields, who is the former member of the Pittsburgh City Council, on which he represented the 5th District from 2004 to 2012, and he also served as the council's president from 2006 to 2010. So I'd like to welcome to the show Doug Shields. Good afternoon, Douglas, and welcome back.
Well, thank you very much, June. I'm glad to be here with you today.
Now, can we begin by just talking about a little bit about the history of fracking, especially it's the whole process in the Northeast? For exactly how long have they been exploring for natural gas in the Northeast?
Well, in 2003, the United States Geological Survey came out with an announcement that there were 96 trillion cubic feet of gas sitting underneath our feet in Pennsylvania in the Marcellus Shale, along with New York, Ohio, West Virginia, and Western Maryland. We, you know, everybody read it in the papers. I did too, and went, gee, I guess that's good. Without understanding, and it's important to understand that, you know, the first gas well was drilled about 25 miles east of the city. There's a long storied history here. You know, this was the birth of the industry. So, and we, you know, Western Pennsylvania certainly has a lot of shallow gas well activity, none of which ever really kind of garnered much attention. You know, and I'm sure it's had its issues, but nothing to the likes of what we see in hydraulic fracturing. The first well was drilled in Washington County, hydraulic fracturing well, by Range Resources, and of course the results were phenomenal. You know, the pressure was high, the flow was great, and everybody knew the shale was there forever. Nobody knew how to extract hydrocarbon fuels from it until the horizontal drilling came about, with the ability to go straight down and then turn that drill head and then go along a shale seam and fracture it and extract the gas from it, or the oil, or whatever. And so as this was going along, the state, now think back, 03, there's gas here. Exploration begins. 2005, the Energy Act of 2005 goes through Congress. It's over 7,000 pages long, and buried in that is probably less than maybe 150 words, which granted to about 16 companies that it impacted a exemption from, you know, the Clean Water Act, Clean Air Act, Superfund Act, and all this other stuff. Now, in a bill like that, nobody understood it. And it's, you know, and I've gone through that act, and it covers a lot of ground. So no one's really picking up on what this meant. The industry knew exactly what it meant. You know, this is their business. They got office buildings full of people and law firms full of people sitting here figuring out the equation and how best to go about this to their advantage. Unfortunately, the institutions of our government that are here to serve us, we the people, don't forget, it's all about us folks, did absolutely nothing. You're sitting on top of the second largest gas play in the world. And what was the response of our government? Oh, nothing's going to happen. Or what could possibly go wrong? There was no due diligence by our institutions of government, be it the Department of Environmental Protection, the Public Health Department, those types of things. Nobody said, gee, maybe we ought to go look at this and see what the impacts are. Maybe we better understand this. Maybe we should begin a discussion, a public discussion, with those that we serve, we the people, to have a discussion about this, whether it's the health, environmental, whether it's as built or natural environment, you know, the public health risk assessments, economic assessments. You know, you've just hitched your economic star to an industry that is in a constant state of boom and bust since it began. We didn't look at localized inflation, where these small rural towns, you know, that had a motel that maybe was 40% occupied at any given time, is now full up. And what does that do? And all of a sudden the price of bread goes up. You know, items in the local community, because of this demand, market demand for whatever it is, room, board, food, drink, whatever, you know, where you had a bar with maybe six guys sitting in there at 8:30, now you got 30. So you jack up the price of beer. You know, localized inflation was never taken into account. Local impacts to local government was never taken into account. And as the state legislature then began to construct what is now Act 13, there were no public hearings on the matter. There was no anything. You know, they did their deals in Harrisburg. They rammed the stuff through and never went back to the people. Now think about this. When Obamacare went through, you saw the film of senators and congressmen going back to their district and getting yelled and screamed at and everything else. There's been no coming back to the people about this at all. And there are, you know, whether it on the engineering side, the bad well casings, the migration of gas, which happens, well explosions, all this other stuff. None of it's been accounted for, one. Two, none of it has been brought forward to the people in any cogent fashion for our consideration in the development of our laws pertaining to this. So the public, we the people, were basically carved out of the equation in total. And so now you have people, you know, it's all anecdotal, it's all episodic, there's a well blowout, there's an earthquake in Youngstown, there's well casing failures in Dimmick, there's all this other stuff, but, you know, I guess that's just part of our new reality. And there's a level of acceptance out there on the part of the public, and that's all you really want. You know, you learn that in government that, you know, if I have a bill for whatever, let's all stop at the stop sign bill.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe people like it, maybe they don't, but I don't need them to have a parade and march down the street and say this is the greatest thing since sliced bread. All I need to do is get you to accept it. And once you've attained a level of acceptance on an issue, you're home free. And to a large part, the public has begun to accept the realities of shale gas extraction, and they accept the truck traffic. They accept denigration of air quality. They accept the fact that they're not getting any contribution in a meaningful way of taxes and such. And all this is now, you shrug your shoulders and go, well, I guess that's the way it is. And what can I, what can I do as a citizen about it? And, for the most part, the industry and their paid political people, the governor and all these guys that are getting tons of money from the gas industry are winning. And they're only winning because the public has this level of acceptance now.
Now, has there been any type of positive financial impact from fracking?
Of course. I mean, you know, I've talked to a lot of different groups and grassroots organizations, and they always bring up this, well, those people are all here from Texas, which is true. Just yesterday's paper in the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, it was announced, the county executive announced that we're going to have direct service to Houston. And when Pittsburgh lost its hub when U.S. Air went down the toilet in bankruptcy and abandoned our airport pretty much, you know, for Pittsburgh being a hub back in the day, you can hop on a plane and be anywhere in the direct flight. Today, you want to travel somewhere, you're invariably going to another hub, Cincinnati, Detroit, or something, to get where you want to go. So a three-hour flight or a two-hour flight now is a six-hour ordeal. And they needed direct flights from Houston to Pittsburgh to bring people here, because that's where, you know, the people that operate these wells are from Oklahoma, Texas, Louisiana. Why? Because that's what they do. They're skilled workers. So they're bringing in the workers, and the public, you know, a lot of my fractivist friends are all raising that issue, and I always say, don't even bother with that. Well, you know, why do you think the industry is out there and their main talking point is jobs and money? There are jobs being created. There are people getting checks, whether by way of a lease or a job driving a truck or some aspect of this industry. But if that's going to be our only arbiter here, then, you know, we're missing the boat. It's all about the money. Well, no, it isn't all about the money. The impacts are real. The state didn't impose an impact fee in lieu of a tax, which is substantially less than what any other state would levy as a tax. And they got $200 million in revenue in. And that revenue now is being distributed into communities that have impacts from drilling. Now, Philadelphia got a piece of that. Philadelphia is not within a 50, 100 miles of a well. But, you know, that's the magic of the legislature and what you bury in the bill. And, of course, the city of Pittsburgh is getting absolutely nothing. But, okay, $200 million comes in from the impact fee. That was for last year. And it's levied about $50,000 per well, and it declines over the life of the well because the production at the well goes down. And my question was, okay, you got $200 million in revenue. Great. What are you going to get next year? And I raised that issue because in this latest cycle, with gas prices, because the market is flush with the product, you know, supply and demand being what it is, the price dropped to around $2 an MCF. Drilling, new drilling in Pennsylvania nearly came to a halt. Hopewell Township near Pittsburgh was drilling central in Washington County, and there's very little activity that was going on and has been going on now. So that means that next year's impact fee is going to be substantially less. So now that I'm a local government, and now I'm using this impact fee to cover holes in my budget or reduce taxes, and when next year's impact fee and revenue stream comes in, it's going to be a lot less. Where am I making that shortfall up? Nobody wants to talk about that. I mean, this is just math. Come on. You know, it's not rocket science. If you're assessing a per-well fee, and then the wells, because of the economy of the gas business, the price drops to $2 an MCF. They can't make profit unless it's at least $3.25 an MCF. So they stop drilling. And then they shifted a lot of their operations into Ohio on the Utica Shale because there's wet gas there, and there was a market for that. That market also has collapsed because of the supply. And so what are you going to get in the long term? And what you're going to get is what other states that have gotten that hitched their wagon to an economic model that is boom-bust. And you're in for a wild ride. You're going to have situations where you'll see good employment, and then all of a sudden the plug gets pulled, and all of a sudden you have unemployment. The hotel that was full is now empty. Those types of things. And people don't understand that. You know, we keep moving through time and space. Stuff doesn't stay the same. That which was good today may be very bad tomorrow. And by hitching your state's economy to it, you know that's why I was like, well, we haven't even crossed the bridge about it as a matter of public policy is what do we do about shale gas exploitation? And now you signed us up for a revenue stream. Now you're on the junk. You can't get off it. You need it. If that revenue stream dries up or is substantially less than the year before, well, you know, the cops, the heat, the light, the salt for the road paving and all this other stuff still needs to be paid for. But now all of a sudden you have revenue shortfalls. So by attaching your local tax base to a boom-bust cycle industry, you really, you know, one of the things that we're always looking for is a reoccurring revenue stream with stability. And if you don't have that stability, then how do you plan for a budget year to year? You can make an estimate that, oh, I'm going to get $200 million a year from the gas industry. Well, that's not true. You know, if it's on a per well count, gee, they stopped drilling beginning in February, March, and they were pulling out rigs all over the place out of here. And places like Tennessee as well, Chesapeake ceased operations there back in February. So, you know, the money is there, but it's not the money that we need to be concerned about. It's the long-term impacts, which are going to have an effect on a lot of money if you got to start trying to clean up the messes from what happened, the contamination of aquifers. I don't even know how much money, if there is enough money to fix that, and down the line. So jobs and money, sure. I'll never deny that they don't create jobs and money. But on the other side of that ledger is that you better start adding up the adverse impacts and what they are going to cost you with health, you know, maintaining your infrastructure, your ability to plan and develop other industries that this one kind of shoves away, real estate. You know, Nationwide Insurance came out, what, a month ago, 2 months ago this past summer, and announced that they would no longer underwrite insurance for properties that were leased. Now, here's an industry that sits down and does risk assessments. Mm-hmm. And based on those risk assessments, they sell insurance to make a profit. They don't sell insurance to pay claims. And they looked at the long-term risks here and said, nah, we're not doing this. Mortgage insurers, the same thing. Banks that will not underwrite mortgages or do refinancings of existing mortgages due to the fact that the surface property collateral is diminished in value and it can no longer secure the note.
Well, you just answered my question. You just answered the question that I was going to ask you about property values. So in essence, as far as property values are concerned, this is not something that's going to prove to be, a good thing for any homeowner.
Right. I mean, if I'm a homeowner, I'm Joe Buyer out in the market. You know, the last thing I want to do, because I understand this as an individual, is I don't need a partner in my property. And I'm not going to, or the neighboring property. Let's say I own my mineral rights and everything else. I'm sitting on 100 acres and everybody around me leased up. I'm still going to get the impacts and the denigration. And who wants to come, you know, buy that a piece of property that where there's a great deal of wealth attached to the material underneath the home and owned by somebody else? And my surface property now is diminished greatly in value. That's a fact. You know, that's a clear fact. You go to Broadview Heights, Ohio, which is a suburban community 15 miles south of the Cleveland city center. Very nice community, a newer community. Homes there about close to 300,000 to 400,000 is a mean price. And they have drilling at the end of their cul-de-sac. Well, who's going to move into that neighborhood? You paid $400,000, and now you want to get out because you got drilling operations literally on lots in between your home and down at the end of the street. And I've seen it. This is not making it up.
So what choices do you have?
Who's going to buy your home? This is the American dream. This is where most Americans, you know, this is their biggest investment. You know, this is where they put all the family's financial eggs in that basket, and you borrow against their equity and so forth. You use them as a financial tool for other things you can leverage with your house. But if you go to the bank and all of a sudden the bank is saying, well, you want to borrow up to 80% of the value of your home, well, guess what? You paid four, but with all this stuff going on around you, that property value is diminished greatly if, you know, and in some cases it has no value at all. Ron Gula is a farmer, and it was one of the first leases in Washington County, and he didn't understand it. He even worked on rigs for a while. His farm is worthless. And he found out about it because he had a couple, 3-acre pond that went dead on him. A neighbor came by to fish it. He kept panfish in it for eating. And he came back about an hour after fishing and said, Ronnie, your pond's dead. Cattails are all dead. The water was black. And there was nothing to be caught. And that's when Ron first realized he had a problem with the contamination. And so he goes, you know, and he owned the farm free and clear. He goes to the bank in Washington County and asks for a loan. And they said, well, what do you want it for, Ron? And they said, you know, he says, oh, man, I need some money. I want to get $100,000. I'm going to have to hire some lawyers and sue these guys. And they got back to him about a week later and said, we can't lend you the money. And he said, why? He said, because your collateral, your property, it doesn't have any value. So if you default on your note and we go to foreclose, we're buying a problem. We're not getting an asset to cover the note. And, you know, that's a real-world deal. Now, Ron spent years fighting them in the courts. I understand he did get a settlement, and they, you know, Range Resources bought the farm, as they say. And, you know, but that farm's dead. It's done. It isn't going to be used again. And as one farmer told me down in Washington County, how do you farm without water? And the answer is you can't.
Mm.
Again, you cannot, as a matter of public policy, give all the weight to the oil and gas industry. You know, Pennsylvania has a $2 to $3 billion a year fishing industry here. You know, recreational fishing. We have some of the best trout streams in the eastern part of the United States. And so that's, again, a $3 billion industry, right? All right, well, if you start denigrating stream quality and this and that and the other, you have a night. Yeah, you made $100 over here drilling, and you lose $200 over here on that industry. You know, if you drive to New York on Highway 81 coming out of Harrisburg, you go past this giant Cabela's with, you know, they sell all that trout fishing equipment and everything. It's huge. You know, they're not there because it's a cheap place to put it. They're there because that's where their market is in Pennsylvania. Mm. And so you're denigrating that. You're denigrating an economy in the farming industry. I've spoken to a number of substantial real estate developers, and one in particular has significant holdings of land throughout western Pennsylvania. And we were having a corned beef sandwich over his desk for lunch one day, and we got talking about Marcellus, and he looked at me and says, you know how many acres we have leased out? And they could have made a lot of money. And I said, how many? And he holds up his hand with a zero, none. He says, it's bad for my business. I develop surface. And by leasing out this land, I cut my own legs off because now I got another issue with lending, insurance, getting people to come and utilize the land for the development, whether it's shopping, commercial, housing, that type of thing. And he said, it doesn't make any economic sense to me. Unfortunately, the culture in the business world is to say nothing. You know, you don't see business people coming out and taking stands on this. Quietly, behind the scenes, there's a level of concern. And, they just don't want to get in a fight with their colleagues or the Chamber of Commerce or whatever. It's not worth their time. But sooner or later, the real estate industry, whether it's, you know, commercial real estate or residential real estate people, or real estate agents and whatnot, are going to have to start coming to grips with this, because this is starting to come into their, you know, into their world in an adverse way. So, you know, that's the whole thing. I mean, the sad thing is we have had no discussion on the matter. We've had a lot of arguments, a lot of finger-pointing, a lot of talking points, but we have had no discussion.
What do you think is going to happen here in New York?
Good question. And, you know, I think, I don't know. That, you know, I wish I did, but, you know, you have a three-year moratorium. That concludes. And Cuomo's sitting there on the fence. Should I or shouldn't I? Right now it looks like he's doing the Pontius Pilate routine where he's washing his hands of it, so to speak. And I get that as a politician, is that, you know, if I say no, I'm going to hurt myself because someday I might want to run for president. Nobody gets to be president unless they get some oil and gas money in the coffers. It's an expensive proposition. But if I do go and say that we should drill and sign off on drilling in New York, now I got all these my grassroots people all mad at me. So it's a lose-lose proposition in a political sense. Me, on the other hand, look at it this way. It's a very easy decision. This is not a tortured decision. There is clear and convincing evidence of harm. There is clear and convincing evidence that this industry doesn't know what it's doing as far as its technology. It doesn't tell the truth. And there are real impacts that are, you know, adversely affecting communities. And the decision becomes an easy one. They haven't met the bar. They didn't pass the bar yet. Here's my bar. You cross this line, we'll start talking about drilling. But you haven't even attained anything close to it, nor have you made any effort, and you've done everything to subvert the public debate.
So how
and then you just tell the gas company, you know, get lost. You know, you guys aren't here yet. And the interesting thing is, though, in this debate, the burden of proof has been shifted to the non-moving party. And what I mean by that, when you go to a court of law, you sue somebody. They could just sit there all day and do nothing. The burden of proof is on the plaintiff. In a criminal court, the burden of proof is on the state, beyond a reasonable doubt. In a civil court, the burden of proof is on the plaintiff bringing the action for damages against somebody to prove that they were the cause of the accident or whatever else the damages might be associated with. But the industry and their political friends have managed to shift the burden of proof away from the moving party, the natural gas and oil drilling companies, and put it on me, the citizen. Well, my well water went bad. I got methane all over. Well, how do we know that that's my methane? You know, this methane is naturally occurring. Well, it comes out of every well in the world all the time. Really? So now I got to go hire geologists, engineers, environmental scientists, and everything else, which I don't have the resources to do for testing. And, you know, you can spend $150,000 to even know if you have a case. And then you go up against an industry that is going to time you out with motions and everything else in a court of law, and they can drag you on for years before you'll never get to the merits of the case. So they managed to shift the burden of proof to us when they were the moving party, and I find that most interesting. You know, Governor Cuomo says, you have to meet these standards. It's clear from the health studies. Well, that health study's in dispute. I don't care if it's in dispute or not. You know, you have to utilize the precautionary principle when you're talking about something of this scale. And if there's reasonable doubt here by way of preponderance of the evidence, which there clearly is, then the answer's no. And until such time that you meet these standards that we, the people, developed to protect our interests, our commercial interest, our personal interest, our property interest, then until you meet that standard, whatever that standard may be, the answer is no. And they haven't done that. But unfortunately, this is getting into where our institutions of government in New York and Pennsylvania have failed us miserably. Like, you know, since 2003, you know, everybody's on notice. What did our institutions of government that are there to serve us do? And the answer is absolutely nothing. In Pennsylvania, there are no environmental studies to look at the impacts on the as-built environment and the natural environment. The Department of Health of Pennsylvania has done nothing by way of beginning to document all this anecdotal evidence of harm. And, you know, so, you know, there was no public discussion. There's no consumer protection laws in Pennsylvania about leasing. You're on your own, kids. This guy shows up at your door and tells you he's going to give you $300 an acre and lie to you and everything else, and there's no disclosure of risk of what might happen. You know, oh, you're going to be a millionaire. We'll give you all this money. And then what happens? Something goes wrong, and you lost, literally, you lost the farm. And, you know, there's nothing out there to, you know, they say the old license plate in Pennsylvania says, you say you have a friend in Pennsylvania. It should say you're on your own in Pennsylvania.
Douglas, we are out of time, but before we go, what would you advise our listeners, especially for the folks that are living in upstate New York that have been actively involved with this whole debate?
Well, I think one of the things is that, one, the activism has to be ratcheted up, and it has to go into the political arena. You cannot allow your elected senators and representatives to sit there and not respond to you, which is what goes on for the most part. Your demand has to be, what about my health, what about my safety, and what about my welfare? And you better not be giving any talking points out there. You need to engage with your elected representatives, and if they don't answer the phone or the door or respond to you appropriately, or if they do respond and say you're full of beans, this is all good, then you're going to have to get politically active and make some changes at the ballot box. And, you know, that's the hard part. And that they're not going to quit. We can't quit either. And for those folks that are out there talking to their neighbors and becoming active, I salute them. You know, it's certainly I garnered some notoriety with the ban in Pittsburgh and whatnot, but these are the folks that are actually making the difference. And that's how it should be in this country. They owe us an explanation, and if they signed up with the oil and gas companies, then we owe them an exit ticket from representing us, because they don't represent us anymore.
Thank you, Doug. And thank you so much, everyone, for tuning in. We are out of time. And, Doug, before we go, can you give our audience your website? And also, if you want to recommend any particular groups that you think people should connect with?
Sure. I don't have a website, but I'd use my Facebook page as a resource page. There's plenty of information there. If people want to Facebook me, please feel free to do so. And there's a constant stream of information that you can utilize to take to your electeds or whoever. And also organizations here such as MarcellusProtest.org has a fantastic website, and I work closely with them, that posts news, you know, meetings, what's going on and that sort of thing, and keep you up to date on what's happening. That would be my one recommendation. Certainly, there are a number of others. All you have to do is type in, Marcellus or Shale Gas Outrage or something like that, and you'll get a list of grassroots sites that are literally around the world, and to begin to start assess that information. So, you know, I guess the first step is to get connected and start understanding this by way of these people that are putting good information out there. The one website that I use a lot, as I said, is MarcellusProtest.org here in the Western Pennsylvania area.
Thank you so much. And thank you, everyone, for tuning in. This has been June Stoyer with the Clean Energy View Radio Show. Have a great afternoon, everyone.